Is it true that children with diagnoses such as ADHD and dyslexia are too quickly labeled as abnormal, and that one vital contributing factor may be overlooked? Hello, I'm Mariëtte Snyman, a journalist devoted to uncovering new ways to understand ourselves, deepen our relationships, and strengthen our emotional well-being. Thank you for tuning into Calm, Clear and Helpful, the weekly podcast series introducing you to wellness professionals, offering their expertise and assistance. Today's topic is learning and reading difficulties in children. Is this the missing link? If learning and reading problems feature in your life or that of a child close to you, I trust that this episode will be an eye-opener. The wellness professional I'm introducing is Professor Jannie Ferreira, optometrist in private practice researching children with learning and reading problems, sports vision specialist, and former head of the Department of Optometry at the University of Johannesburg, speaking from Hartbeespoort, where he currently resides. Welcome, Jannie.
Good morning. Yeah, thank you for inviting me onto your program.
I'm very curious to hear what you're going to say. Jannie, you focus on reading and learning difficulties in children, as explained in your brand new book, very important, Learning and Reading Frustrations, A Message of Hope. Now, this is a very practical guide to understanding and overcoming learning and reading challenges, and you approach the increase in diagnoses such as ADHD and dyslexia from a very unusual standpoint. Could you give a short description of the contents of your book?
Thanks, Mariëtte. Yeah, the main intention is to give a message of hope to all of those who deal with children with learning and reading problems. And those are mostly, absolutely parents that is involved, and then teachers. And I tend to show you that we are dealing with normal children, because these messages that we're getting from the outside is that we are actually dealing with abnormal people. The moment you present with one of these things, you have an abnormality. And I intend to show that we're dealing with normal children, normal people, exhibiting abnormal behavior. And if we can determine what causes children to act abnormally, we can change the lives of the children and the parents for the better. And this is where the missing link would come in, to show you how critically important that is. And we will certainly talk about that later. So hopefully, and that's my message I want to get out, that we shall stop labeling children as being inherently abnormal. And it's very easy to lose perspective, because you will get bombarded with so many different views. I mean, if I looked at the literature, you'll find more than 300,000 references to this topic. So I can see why parents can get confused. Because who are you going to believe? What one of these are you going to follow? So the challenge is to show that learning and reading challenges, what I call mostly a predisposition, and it's not a destiny. And if we know how to deal with it very quickly, then we would see happy children. And yes, the challenge is to do it in a concise, in a rather lengthy manner.
Yes, which is very true of your book. I must say, it is a very easy read. I mean, it's not that the subject matter is not complex, but you present it in a very clear and concise way.
Yeah, thank you. That was quite a challenge, but that's what I wanted to do, to put it in language that the general people would understand. And not in a very scientific manner.
Yes. Before we come to your book, could you give us a brief summary of your career? I noticed it has taken quite a few interesting turns.
Well, Mariette, God has walked an amazing route with me. I didn't realize at the time, but now looking back, I can just go on my knees. Because it's just amazing how everything came together. You're quite right. I started off in animal physiology, and I obtained a PhD in animal physiology, and through that, a clear understanding of physiological processes that's involved. And then I was also quite involved in the world of sport at the highest level of coaching, administration. I was at SA Rugby Board. I was the president of the Golden Lions. And then my career took a change, and I entered optometry. Now, if you put together these three items, physiology, sport, and optometry, I then established what was called the Academy of Sport Vision. Now, again, through the grace of God, this academy was considered by the International Olympic Committee as one of the three best of its kind in the world. Because of that, I was also part of the SA Olympic Committee's high performance for 13 years. And I worked on improving visual skills in these athletes. That was critical for their performance. Because, yes, I will approach this whole thing from a visual side because that's what I'm trained in and what I understand. Now, this is where the interesting thing came in. When I was working with these athletes, I noticed how many of them were interchanging hand and foot. You know, sometimes they use the left hand, sometimes the right hand, and then they maybe use the right foot, but the left hand. And that triggered my whole interest in the dominance factor. And then also, they admitted to me that they have never enjoyed learning and reading. That also got my mind going. So yeah, I started exploring the role of the dominant eye, and 25 years of research and more than 10,000 case studies on the importance of visual skills and the dominant eye in learning and reading, this is why I wrote this book. So what I'm telling you is not something that I woke up one morning, thumbsuck. This comes a long way, and indeed working with many, many different children and also spending lots of time on my knees saying, God, am I really doing the right thing? And as I said, I just keep on getting this positive feedback from people to say yes. And that was indeed to say, okay, let's try and get this message out as wide as possible.
Yes, and in line with that, a scientific approach is very important to you.
Absolutely, absolutely. And if you know, I looked at my background, that's why taking on a scientific approach was fairly easy for me. Because from my background, it's very clear that the only way to get reliable answers is to do it very scientifically. Because currently, the most common approach in looking at ADHD in these things is to purely look at the list of symptoms. And I want to know what the cause is. And that's what we do in the science. If you take on a subject, you go and find the cause. And from there, you build further. So therefore, my plea is that we should adapt our approach. And this is what this book is about, to say, can we adapt our approach? Because the moment you start searching for possible causes, you'll find quite a number of conditions or syndromes that presents with the same symptoms as ADHD. So please, let's stop immediately going on to an abnormal child suffering from ADHD. So yeah, it is absolutely true for problems with visual skills, and the scientific literature indicate that between 70 and 80% of learning and reading may be the result of poor visual skills. So please let's stop and just looking at symptoms and not consider what actually all the different things that may produce those symptoms that we are seeing. I've done a study on myself with my dear wife where we went and did a whole school that where the children are coming from an informal settlement. And 70% of those children in grade 4 to 7 had poor visual skills. And the headmaster was surprised because all of them struggled with learning and reading. So this is something that goes across all boundaries. It's so critical that we have developed good visual skills because vision is basis for all learning and reading. And yeah, sadly, I feel our society seems to have an obsession in seeking for syndromes. Maybe a little bit by the side, but something that is fairly common now is the so-called ODS, the Opposition Defiant Syndrome. And that is something that I want to explore further. Because hear me, Opposition Defiant Syndrome is children that objects to the fact that they've been labeled. And the moment they do that, what happens? They've just been given another label. And why? I had contact with people that worked with drug addicts. And just very brief study showed that many of them are actually battling with the dominance factor. And I want to go and do a proper study to show the sad, sad thing that these poor people and children get so despondent that they get off the track and may even become drug addicts. It sounds crazy, but sadly true.
Yeah, I would be very interested in following that study when you get to it. Yanni, shall we look at the causes of the meteoric rise in diagnoses such as ADHD and dyslexia?
Yeah, first of all, let's just say that currently the common way is to see ADHD as a psychiatric disorder.
Yes.
While dyslexia is seen as a brain dysfunction. And the moment you do that, then you consider these things to be a genetic condition. So, you know, it's inherited. And the implication with genetics, by all means, is that you cannot change it. The only thing that you can try and do is manage it. And then what's happening is that most of these cases are now, say, let's take medication. And not even consider all the side effects that we can get with this medication. Now, it's interesting to see that I'm not the only one that's starting to question this. What was very interesting is to see that in the world of psychiatrists themselves, they are now questioning to say, but maybe Lucas different. And so they have two. The one that I've just mentioned is the so-called neurobiological model. I mean, that's inherited. And they base this all on behavioristic elements. So that's the only profession where you do make a diagnosis only based on symptoms. You don't do any scientific tests to try and prove that.
I just want to ask, do you mean the symptoms, you mean that is certain forms of behavior?
Yeah, and what you'll see, I've listed them all. I've listed them all in the book.
Yes, you did.
It's the whole thing. The child is not concentrating. He's lazy. He's fell asleep. He's jumping letters, words. All those lists appear there. And that's what they look at. And we'll come back to it a little bit later of how they actually just keep on adding to these lists. But the other part that's now really coming to the fore from psychiatric environment is the so-called social construction theory. Now that I like. I actually met a lady, Linda Moss, psychiatric practitioner, and she did a PhD on the diagnosis of ADHD. And she concluded that ADHD is indeed what's called a social construction, which means it's not genetic. It's how the child interacts with the environment. And she showed clearly that the diagnosis can actually change the attitude and the way people then behave towards these children. You see, and now I can go back and to say, can you see how these poor children would just go into a dump, okay? And there are other studies then that came in to say, but hang on, the effects of labeling children with ADHD can also then reduce the teacher's expectations of academic achievement, which in turn are associated with actually lower achievement scores. And furthermore, this diagnosis may have a profound effect on the child's self-perception. And these kind of labels encourage a focus on the child's deficits as opposed to the things he and she does well. And now maybe you may understand why I almost had an obsession to write this book and to say, can we please stop doing this to people worldwide? And can we please just dig deeper into finding the reason for the child's behavior? And then realize, but hang on, there's a number of reasons why people may act abnormally. And by acting abnormally, please, they are not abnormal. It is what causes that. Yeah, but you actually asked more so on why the meteoric rise.
Yes, because I know your book offers many insights into that.
Absolutely. And let me just confirm, we're talking millions. Sadly so, we're talking millions of people now worldwide that get labeled. And it's not just children, it's also adults. And we'll explain that a little bit later. As I said, there are a number of reasons for this meteoric increase, and we'll quickly look at them all. But first and foremost is the lifestyle changes that the child of the 21st century is experiencing. You know, they are experiencing more changes in technology than all previous generations together went through. We don't realize it, okay? We don't realize how quickly these things take place. I mean, when I did my PhD in the early 1980s, the computer I used was as big as my lounge today. And now you can do 10 times more on a thing as small as a cell phone today. So it's crazy, and it really started at the beginning of the turn of the century. I mean, when Google was registered as a domain, then USB flash drives were launched in the same year. In 2005, YouTube was launched. In 2006, you saw Facebook and Twitter, and the list just goes on and on how quickly this decided. Happened. And yes, it was around about 29 where technology moved from the computer to the cell phone. So you can do almost as much on your cell phone today as you could do on the computer. And so it all followed. iPad, Instagram. I saw reports that in 2012, Facebook had more than 1 billion active users. So what we're seeing today is this major change, and that our children are absolutely caught up in this change in technology. And we will discuss it a little bit later, is can they deal with it, yes or no? Or should we expose them to that yes or no? But as I said, remember the other factors as well. We've drawn a line through genetic, because genetic changes take ages to happen, so certainly not. But if you use genetic language, it's the phenotype, not the genotype. Now, what I mean with that, it's the interaction of the genotype with the environment. In other words, the interaction of the individual with the environment. And it's this interaction of the child, well, the adult, with the current environment that can cause this absolutely. And the sad thing is that, as I said to you, the main thing still is the so-called psychiatric neurobiological model. And they've built a list of symptoms, which they call the DSM, started around about the 1990s. And they send all these symptoms out. And when a child has a number of these symptoms, he can be diagnosed as ADHD. Sadly so, since the 1990s, they just keep adding more symptoms to this list. So the list just gets longer and longer. The other thing is that in the 1990s, children had to be 12 years old before they could be diagnosed as ADHD. But now this has changed. In around about 2010s, that children at the age of 7 can now get this label. And sadly so, I'm now seeing children age 4 that's been referred to me, that's been diagnosed by ADHD. So it's obvious to see how quickly it is, or why the list is actually growing. And more so, the latest trend is to move to what we call a spectrum approach, which is quite common in autism, which means that you can have one or two of these symptoms, then you end on the lower end of the spectrum, and then when you get many of them, you end on the higher end of the spectrum. But can you see what the spectrum does? It immediately puts you to say you actually have autism. It's sad, it's sad. As I said, I cannot understand why society today just wants to put labels to everybody. And this is, and the same thing happens, that those symptoms can actually be anything else and not just that specific diagnosis which they were making. Right, so we need to be careful. We certainly need to be careful before we decide to make any of these diagnoses. The big reason? Yeah, so we're making the net much larger to catch more individuals. And I'm not going to go into why, because there are many different reasons why people would probably want to do that. But just remember, very interesting, that the only people that are allowed to actually make these diagnoses are people from medical and medical-related professions. But again, if you look at the literature, you'll see that most of these and psychiatric practitioners actually admitted to me that most of these diagnoses are now made by teachers. And that's sad, because the teacher have no right, because teachers will tell parents they think the child has ADHD. And what would parents then do? They go onto the internet. And it's not just in the field of ADHD, but across the whole medical field, that people are now going and doing self-diagnosis. I'm going onto the internet, I'm looking at Google, I'm talking to Google, and then I'm actually diagnosing myself. And that is something that we need to be extremely, extremely careful, not just in, as I said, in the field of ADHD, but in a whole approach as far as medical situations is concerned. So, may I just say that in most cases, people, I'm talking about teachers and non-medical people, that many of them, most of these people would make the diagnosis because they were educated this way. And I found that because I've traveled to schools on invitation and went to speak to teachers and also to parents on meetings, and that's what they said to me. That what I'm telling them is the first time they heard this, that they were not educated to that. So they're not, and I want to say that to teachers. I'm not saying to teachers, look, you deliberately actually ran down these children. They were actually thinking that they're doing the right thing. And hopefully with this book, we will now say to them, please don't do that. Go and think differently. And yeah, that is one of the major things that I want to achieve with the book, is to say, please think before you diagnose or add a label.
Yeah, you are hoping to bring about a mind shift. Now, Jannie, in your book, you explain how 21st century living environment impacts on children. And you mention sensory development and integration, physical literacy, the visual system, and then you also say that it eventually impacts brain development. Could you discuss these factors?
Again, as I said, I've discussed that fairly extensively, but I'll try and be short this time around. Let's put it very straightforward. The time that's spent on screens today even from baby time, is creating the biggest challenges. I don't know, maybe I'm set to be on the lookout for these things. How often do I see little babies sitting on cell phones with a cell phone in hands? You can go and look and see how many pictures you'll get on Google with this. Well, I have friends where I actually saw that the little baby sitting and playing on a cell phone. And then you can buy prams today where the bracket for the iPad's really fixed to it. So what I'm saying is from very, very early age, our children is now exposed to this technology, which we referred to a little bit earlier. And the bottom line is just simply that the little child's visual system is not capable of dealing with this. If you study the literature on sensory development, you will find that it's crucial for brain development because it helps to build nerve connections in the brain pathways. And quite often, some people get to refer to this as the critical first 1,000 days. I say that's roughly 4 years. So the first 4 years of a child's life is going to be critically important how this child is going to develop, and more so the brain development. And again, I don't think I've said it, but it's been 25 years that I've been researching this. And way back in 2014, I was asked to present at the international conference. And interesting enough, the conference was called Play. And I stressed the need for young children to spend more time of their day playing. And I used a very simple example to explain this to them. I don't know how many of you still remember that hollow ball, which had various shapes and forms cut out.
Yes, my children had one of those.
Can you see, I'm surprised how many people actually know this.
Yes.
And that's why I mentioned it. So, and now the child needs to match the shapes and the forms with the holes in the ball. And yeah, I'm amazed at how many households this was very common. So what does this require? It requires a visual perceptual skill, a bit of eye-hand coordination to pick up this little piece. And while I'm picking it up, I'm touching it and I'm feeling it. The young child may even put pieces in her or his mouth to try and taste them, and can also shake the ball, involving hearing, and the ball can also be rolled or kicked or thrown around and is therefore an excellent toy to integrate all the several senses and assist in general brain development and movement development. And now, today's children, they still have their toy, but what's it now? It's a picture on a screen where the child uses one finger to drag the shape into an appropriate hole, and then all hell broke loose and fires and crackers and things going off to congratulate them. I think it's very obvious to see how doing the ball thing with the screen thing is two completely different environments. And sadly, this lack in sensory integration of all the senses is going to carry forward. So by the time the child enters school or by the time he reaches that 4 years cutoff point, these skills integrations will not be in place. So, yeah, they've never learned to integrate their body parts. They don't know how to isolate and grasp. They don't know how to coordinate these things. And because of that, the integrated use of both brain hemispheres is also not what it should be. Okay, now remember, sensory skills are all those what we normally know. It is vision, it is hearing. Vision is one of the first things to develop. And smell, touch, and then also vestibular. Vestibular simply where the child, and we're so chuffed when our babies do that the first time, they can keep their head in position in space, because that's critical for the initial balance. And then what we call proprioception, the information that we send to the muscles and joints, you know, starting from the shoulders and go down till they can start using their little bit, the hands. Now, this needs to be integrated with vision. because this is where the fine motor movements that is required for writing and catching a ball is lost. And furthermore, with the ball, visual stimulation results in an expanding of spatial knowledge, develops muscular strength and coordination, which all is also lost in staring at the screen. As is, I can go on and on about this, but the basis is our children are not developing this critical sensory integration. Physical literacy actually builds onto this. And there's even a whole organization nowadays that speaks to this and trying to convince parents and teachers and coaches, because it's also by all means in the world of sport, to encourage people to have children really developing these fundamental motor skills, all the different kinds of physical activities, the movement. Because interesting enough, they would tell you it's not only supporting brain development, but it also supports language development.
Oh.
And I was surprised to see that. Yeah. And I went and I studied the literature, and it's very obvious. That's crazy that it actually also impacts on the language development, not just brain development. Okay. And again, why are we saying this? Because this can happen if there's an overexposure to handheld devices that can certainly develop. May I just say one thing at this stage, Maria? I'm not against technology. This is the current world. Children need to be technologically savvy, because children that in school today, it's quite possible that by the time they get into grade 12, they may actually do everything on the laptop or a Kindle or iPad. So I'm not against technology. But what is critical, particularly in the first 4 years, is how we expose the children to that so that we can get the good stuff out of it and not the bad stuff. And you know, parents don't realize that the child, him or herself, don't realize that they're battling with certain schemes because they don't know better. And when you talk to children today, quite often you'll be amazed at his child, how they can communicate things and their general knowledge. Because that's what they do. Some time ago, I went to the rural part here in the Northwest Province and went and spoke to teachers and parents at a particular school. And I've asked the great ones, who of you have a cell phone? All of them, except one little boy. And what are you doing with your cell phone? YouTube, Wim, YouTube. So there he's looking at pictures. And as I said, that's why they built this absolute amazing general knowledge that they have. But sadly, I cannot now take that general knowledge and convert it into what I would need when I have to start learning and reading. So, yeah, you're going to not obviously see it. The only time when you're going to start finding out the children is in trouble is exactly when they enter into the formal school situation. Okay? Right, so yeah, the guys talking about physical literacy has got a very nice saying where they say that a child that's not physical literate will struggle to become reading and numeric literate. So the important thing, as I said, is it's really important to see how our children spend their day. This modern lifestyle, spending time on screens, means there's a decrease in physical activity. There's no unstructured playtime. And sadly, that is those children that are being threatened by possible visual and reading frustrations and learning. And as I said, add to that the visual part, because vision, or the visual integration, the visual motor integration, builds on the development of the sensory structures as well as the physical literacy. So if those two are not in place, visual motor integration will not take place. And the other thing which I haven't mentioned up to now is visual stress. And what is critical as far as visual stress is concerned is if you look at these children, when they do play on these things, see how close they actually hold this the cell phone or thing to their face. So if a little baby is doing this and holding this about at 20 centimeters from their face, and have a look and you'll see it is truly like that. There's no ways that those two little eyes can deal with that strain, and there's no ways that these two eyes are going to develop properly in combined activities. So visual stress can happen at any time during life. Because remember, it's not just children. We as adults are also spending, well, again, if you go into the literature, how many people are spending more than 7 hours a day looking at computer screens? And now God never built our system to take on so much strain. I always joked when I spoke to my students, I said many ages ago, we did very little activities close up. Our forefathers would wake up in the morning, rub the sleep from their eyes, and then look at the mountains to see where tonight's dinner is walking. So our world was wide open, and as we changed our whole lifestyles, our lifestyles came in closer and closer. And our system is not built to deal with that in sustained ways. Well, you only need to ask people that's over the age of 40,
yeah,
and start battling to see close up to really understand what these children are actually now going through at a much earlier age. And yes, the impact that that then would certainly have on the whole development of the visual system. And therefore, as I said, this then becomes one of the main reasons why children would battle with learning and reading.
Yeah. And if listeners think this is quite a mouthful, you explain it so beautifully in your book, you know, each of these components, and there are also some striking images there. You have an image there of young children sitting in front of these screens, and one can really get a sense of the eye strain, you know, what it must do to the eyes to be in that position for any length of time.
Absolutely. And interesting enough, I always say when I speak to optometrists and trying to get them to follow my procedures, is that there's two sides to the coin as far as vision is concerned. If you have so much time that you spend it near, the one is what we're talking about now, that the visual system doesn't develop properly, or because of the visual strain, this is why the child would get out of the task, because the eyes getting tired really quickly. And that's what children would do. They would just say, I don't enjoy it. I'm not going to do it.
Hmm.
And then, as I said, we click to say the child's naughty or lazy or whatever. I always say to parents, your children are sending messages to you in big fat letters, but you don't understand it.
Yeah.
So the one side is that it's going to impact on the way that the child learns or reads. But there's the other side. Those that really try hard and keep on persevering, you know what's happening to them? They're losing their distance vision. Therefore, you'll see so many children nowadays would be short-sighted at before the age of 10. I mean, in countries like Singapore and China, they're absolutely down on the ground to see how many children are losing distance vision. If you listen to the World Health Organization and people that's dealing with children health, they would say to you, listen to this, 450 million children worldwide is impacted by that.
Sure.
Can you see why I just had this voice in me to say, you need to put this on paper. We need to get this message out.
Yes.
So, yeah, indeed, that is true.
Yanni, now we're coming to the dominance factor. for those of us who are not completely clear on what you mean by dominance, could you explain?
Absolutely. Because dominance here is reflecting to how our bodies are put together. So each of us have a brain profile. And you can go and read on that. I've dealt with it in a book as well. So you're going to be either left dominant or right dominant. Now, remember how the body works. So all your paired structures is sitting in this situation. So my left foot, my left hand, my left eye, my left ear communicates with the right side of my brain, the right hemisphere of the brain. And by all means, the opposite from the other side. Or your right structures communicates with your left side of the brain. And this is where the dominance comes in. Now, the dominance factor is always there. It's for all of us. But what is critical is that I always say we're not a left brain person or a right brain person. We are a whole brain person. And we will function accordingly. But the moment our system goes under strain, how you're going to act in a certain situation will be determined by whether you're right brain or left brain dominant. And that's where the dominance factor comes in. So if we can control the strain, yes, then we can function normally. So it's the strain, and the strain here comes from the visual system that you then enforce you to lean over to your dominant side. And our society is built for people that's right hand, right eye, right foot dominant, not for our lefties. And again, God walked a wonderful way with me. You may be surprised that I'm one of our identical twin, but my twin brother is right dominant. I'm left dominant. And we actually called what they call mirror image twins. So I experienced it in my own life, that there were things that my twin brother could do, which I had to work harder to do because he was right dominant and I'm left dominant. So in our society, what then means is that when we're reading from left to right. And the right eye is enjoying that because the right eye wants to track from left to right. Now here's where the problem comes in. If we understand our lefties and we want to read, our left eye tracks in the opposite direction. Our left eye tracks from right to left. And now you can understand why the B's and D's and the numbers and all those things are written the wrong way round. And when you do that, they would immediately label you as dyslexic. Now, interesting enough that the communities and societies in the far east of our world always laughed and said, you know what, these things are part of your Western culture because we don't really see it in our cultures. And that was amazing because remember in China they read up, down, and now they started reading left to right and suddenly it started appearing there. So that's where the dominance factor really comes in. And the dominance factor is not new. It intrigued society for centuries. It was not uncommon to hear old stories from old people who were left-handed, were forcefully converted into using their right hand, because that's the next point I want to make under dominance factor. I'm left-handed, so they couldn't even hit me out of being left-handed. Mm-hmm. So at least all my structures on the one side. The people that's suffering most is those that were forced to change their left hand for their right hand. So what you've now created is cross dominance or mixed dominance. And that is the big, big problem. Not that long ago, a guy did a study where he used over 50,000 people to try and see what the dominance ratios are. And he then concluded that about 10-11% of people worldwide is left-handed, which is true. But amazingly so, when he looked at the dominant eyes, he saw that 34% of people were actually left eye dominant. And he couldn't give an explanation for that. Now, that is just quite possible, that almost 24% of people in the world were forced out of their left hand onto their right hand and now still sitting with left eye dominant, because that's the only thing you change. The left eye remains dominant. And if you look at the statistics worldwide, how many people are suffering from learning reading? Anything between 20 and 30%. So you can truly now ask the question, how many of these are actually those class dominant children or people? And yes, it's again, as I said, what I'm saying in the book is I didn't discover these things. It's out there because it's more than 100 years that researchers were trying to link dominance or laterality, as they called, with academic performance and even intelligence. And even as early as 1936, researchers did establish, according to them, a link between left and what they called mixed manual ocular behavior and reading disability. In the many publications and PNSV, that left-handedness or left-eye dominance, and they call it a disability. You see, that's what they think about our lefties.
Yeah. May I ask you something?
Yeah, sure.
As a lefty myself, I was wondering when I read your book, does it mean when you are left-handed that you are automatically left-eye dominant?
That is a question that people are asking often. And all I can say about that is that because, as I just said to you, that the body, the dominance profile is structured that, paired structures that if you left eye, so that you can communicate with the right side of the brain. The moment you have one structure that is on the one dominant side and the other on the other, what you're now doing is you're sending a mixed message to the brain. Can it happen? I'm not sure. I have to be honest. I'm not sure that happens, but from my own experience, it is very limited. What is also important, and I've done that a couple of times, is how do you actually establish this? What kind of tests would you do to decide what is the dominant? Hand and foot's easy.
Yeah.
But the moment you're coming to eye, there are various techniques that you can use to decide which eye is dominant. And not one of those techniques, as I said, I have to admit that, is 100% accurate. I quite often use three different techniques just to make sure that what I'm seeing is indeed that. But because we're just talking hand, the moment I'm seeing that the child is left foot dominant, and I'm wondering whether about the eye and the hand, then I know, okay, I think the chance is very good that we're sitting here with a mixed dominant situation.
Yeah.
And while you're saying that to me, you may know that, as I said, through the grace of God, I'm sitting with 6 degrees behind my name. So our lefties, it's not as if we can't read or learn. We actually enjoy that. But when we grew up, as you know, I'm on the other side of 70 already. We didn't have that much strain on our systems.
Yeah.
Before our system taken on so much strain that dominance would kick in, our work was done. So that's why, again, we're coming back to our current lifestyle that puts the vision on a strain and therefore the system is immediately going onto the dominant side much sooner, much quicker than we ever had. And that's why we survived.
What do you mean by that?
Well, in survival and means is that earlier years, it was there. It was always there. But because our systems then and even right up to the 1990s didn't take that much close-up strain, we could survive because our eyes would still work together. It wouldn't just jump over to the dominant side.
Yeah.
So that is the big change that we've seen, is that the dominant side needs to kick in much often now So that's where the left eye dominant people are in trouble. And as I said, when you left eye and left hand like me, at least all the message are going to the same side of the brain. It's when you force people out of their left hand that now part of the message goes to the right brain and the other part goes to the left brain.
I see.
And that's where, and I do mention it in the book, and you can read about it. Interestingly enough, one of the major problems then is language. Because now the brain has to rewire to deal with these different symptoms.
Mm.
And that's exactly where the problem comes in and why people then would present with all these different symptoms. And that's why much earlier I said to you, it's a predisposition.
Yeah.
And when does it become a destiny? When we're under strain or when, and sadly so, it still happens today. There are children that's left-handed would still be forced out of their left hand. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's not new. I mean, a guy like Einstein, again, if you go and read the literature, you'll see there's a lot of arguments about him. Was he left-hand or right-hand dominant? Einstein was left. But in those ages, it was absolutely unacceptable to be left. So he converted himself to use his right hand. So the other thing which I always say, if you have people that's ambidextrous, then immediately you can accept you're actually working with a lefty.
My goodness.
Because it's lefties trying to adjust to our right dominant world that we live in. And that made him acceptable in the scientific community the moment. And yeah, you can go and look. It's crazy if you really dig it. Sometimes I think this has taken over my life completely. I like Johann Sebastian Bach was in the same position.
Yeah, I was very interested to read that in your book.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm not sure about you, Moret, but as I said, when we were younger, we didn't have that much strain. But you may realize that you actually had to work hard to perform at school. It's not something that came easy. So when I see children now, and that's my other study I want to do in South Africa, is our farming community. Because I had so many children coming across the country, I sometimes go on my knees if I see how far people come to see me with their children. And how many of these children are children from farmers? And then farmers often said to me that they didn't enjoy learning and reading. And they were actually told at school, you know what? You'll never be able to study. You better need to go and farm.
My goodness.
The amazing thing about that, because it's not stupid people, because sadly, that's what children think if they get these labels. They think they're stupid or silly or dumb. And I make a point to tell them it's not that. So you know what we created? We created a phenomenal farming community. That's why we have such incredible farmers, because they're highly intelligent people that's in the farming. And that is the other study I want to do, is to see how many left-handers or left-dominant people are in our farming community. And just off the top of my head, I will not fall off my chair if it's more than 50% of our farming community.
That sounds like that might be a conclusive outcome. Now, Yanni, I also want to ask you, in your book, you highlight both how to prevent reading and learning frustrations. For instance, how one should balance one's children when they are working with screens, help them achieve a balance when they are working with screens. Yeah. And then you also say how to address them when they already exist. Would you like to give some pointers to preventing these difficulties?
Absolutely, because that's the critical part. And there's that old saying that says prevention is better than cure. So if we can prevent it, then by all means, we are on the right track. First and foremost, we should manage our children's activities much better than we do right now. As I said to you earlier, cell phones, iPads and things now became the latest babysitter. And how often would you see that even in restaurants where families having dinner or lunch or whatever, their children are playing on their cell phones. So if mom and dad wants to discuss things, how do you keep your child quiet? You just put the cell phone or iPad in their hands. And we need to. As I said, I'm not against the technology. We need the technology. Parents need to. Please, please, please manage this better. Well, if you look at the World Health Organization, they would tell you, please, no screen time for children under the age of one. And for people up to the age of four, now you know the age of four is that so-called turning point where everything needs to be in place to really have a system that works well. Up to the age of four, only 1 hour per day. And it's not uncommon to really speak to children and to parents and see that how many of children under the age of four can spend up to 7 hours a day on these devices. So first and foremost, manage the time that your child spends on technology, okay? And as I said earlier on, parents wouldn't realize that because kids are so streetwise because of watching all the YouTube videos. But yes, more than anything else, that's the thing. And then, as we discussed the whole thing about visual strain and visual motor perceptual integration, it's the distance that the child holds these devices from their eyes. And again, if they spend too much time on these devices, then they would cause visual motor, terrible term, visual motor perceptual integration problems. That the eye-hand coordination and the message that goes to the brain is not what it's supposed to be. And the visual strain would cause them later when they go to school to stop. Because now if they develop visual strain, they may say, okay, I can put the thing to one side. But when I'm getting into a school situation, then I'm forced. When a teacher asks me to do this work, I cannot now just sit back and say no. I'm not ready to do it now. Oh, yeah. And one thing I should have told you before, and that actually links up, interesting enough, with our physical literacy, is that when we go under strain, we will go back to the more primitive actions that we need. So when a child sits on a chair and the whole body coordination is never developed properly, he's going to fiddle on his chair. And he's not going to concentrate on reading or writing because his system is managing it in such a way to say, you need to focus on keeping your little bum on a chair because you're going to fall out. And the concentration is not at the task what is needed. And again, what do we tell the child? Sit still. Sit quiet. You're not gaining anything. So again, the child is sending messages to us which we don't understand. Right, so what I'm doing is to give children near-point glasses, okay, to make sure that these near-point glasses reduces the strain so that the eyes can work together. And I think I've told you before, I've done more than 10,000 of these cases.
Yeah.
And therefore, I have the knowledge to know it's working. Therefore, I keep on seeing people that's been referred by friends or family, which children are helped. I mean, I go on my knees if people come in and tell me about so-and-so, which was on his way to a special school, and this child has now completed matric and is just doing engineering at one of our universities. So it is how phenomenal this change can take place if you manage it properly. That keeps me on the other side of 70 still going because I just have this message from God that I need to try and keep making a difference in people's lives. And it's just amazing to see this.
Yes, and I'd like to repeat that you are in private practice in the Hartbeespoort vicinity, right?
Yeah, I've moved to Hartbeespoort. Well, again, that is almost a testimony on its own, Mariette. I've been in Johannesburg all my career at RU and then at University of Johannesburg. And then about 14 years ago, I moved out to Hartbeespoort. I had enough of the city.
Yeah.
I was just had enough of traveling 3 hours a day. And then 2 years ago, I decided, which is strange, everybody laughed to say, how on earth can you move your practice at the age of 70? And I did, and still people are coming because of the difference we're making.
Yes, wonderfully. Yeah. And then, Yanni, you would like to, I would like to say, train or alert more optometrists to what you are doing. What can optometrists do if they would like to be part of this mind shift that you are creating?
Fair enough. May I just say, because I don't think I've answered you properly there, is how do we go about, you know, in preventing or dealing with children with learning and reading difficulties? Is the first, we talk about the near-point glasses, but the important thing is to try and find the cause. That we said right in the beginning, please don't just concentrate on the symptoms. Try and find the cause, because the cause can be more than just, I mean, I haven't even mentioned the educational system, socioeconomic situations, problems in the home. So there's a whole list. So you need to find the cause before you know how to try and approach this problem with children. A very nice example, which I had, interesting enough, you know, while I'm thinking about it, both coming out of London. The one, this is a bit out of line, but this is what happens in this right-handed world of us. Can you believe it? I got a WhatsApp from a medical student standing in an operating theater in London and saying to me, she can't function because all the instruments in the theater are for right-handed people. Sure. What should she do? I fell off my chair getting this. Well, in the end, I said to her, but just get an assistant and you can explain the assistant what to do. It's crazy. But the other thing was to just use the example of please determine the cause. I was involved because I was asked to comment on that where there was a school in England, in London. Now, as you know, the English schools, the children would go on to the underground train and then get off at the station close to the school and then walk to the school. Now, what's happened in this particular school is the teachers were up in arms because of all these children that presented with ADHD symptoms. And when I said to them, but go and try and find a cause, see what happens. You know what happened? These kiddies, when they got off the train at the station where they have to then walk to school, there was a tuck shop. And all of them would go to the tuck shop and buy sweets. And as they walked to school, they would eat these sweets. So what happens when they arrive at school? Oh, boy, they're so pumped up that you can't get them to concentrate. Can you see a simple example like that?
Yeah.
That can say to you. And I don't know why this also comes up in my mind, because I did a study under educational psychologists some time ago, because I saw little girls coming in with this, and I asked them to just let me know how many of their clients, little girls under the age of 10, are on antidepressant drugs. Listen to this. 1 out of 10 little girls from each of these people were on antidepressants before they reached the age of 10. Then I say, but you didn't look at the cause. You saw these dear girls, and that's what your goals are. You're so eager to please, so if you can't, you go on a strain. And how do we handle that with you? We just put you on an antidepressant drug. Then I say to you, but please, please, isn't that a good example to say, go and try and find the cause, and not just try and deal with the symptoms. So that is definitely the most important thing, is keep on digging and trying to find the cause.
Yeah, that is an excellent way to approach it. And then you also show in your book that there are as you said, there may be many factors contributing to or causing certain behaviors and signs that one sees. And then very often, but not always, the visual problem is the one that is overlooked.
Indeed. And that's why I said, please, I'm coming from a visual background, so I'm not trying to tell you all is visual.
Yeah.
I'm the first to say it's not all visual. But I've just seen from my side that if you deal with the visual, interesting enough, then some of the other possible causes may also get less or even disappear. So that's why the emphasis for me is to really deal with the visual system.
Exactly.
I'm in a process, to answer your question, to put together a webinar for optometrists, because the kind of test that you do is not tests that you would see in a so-called normal eye test situation, because these things of battling the visual strain, the eyes not comfortable together, they're not focusing properly, changing focus, they're not tracking properly. Those are things that if you don't look for it and you don't test for it, it's not going to jump to you. So in the webinar, I will discuss with the optometrist what are the things that they need to be on the lookout for to pick up all these visual strain that may cause all these symptoms that is then ending up with all these labels. So hopefully I can get that off the ground soon, because yes, it's part of my passion that I want to help people. And I certainly can't do it on my own, and I want more people to be helped worldwide. So I've even been in contact with people in the United States and the UK, and talking to them, optometrists, as to how they should go about to include these tests in their general examination.
Yeah. Yeah, Jannie, what I'll do is, as soon as you've got the webinar up and running, then I'll put the information in the podcast notes. But I would also suggest that optometrists who are interested could contact you. And while we're speaking of that, where can listeners get hold of you?
Well, easiest way is probably to go onto my website, because I think my email address is on there as well. So my website is just simply www.janniferrerabooks.co.za. And you'll get the information there on the book, but also my email address is there. And yes, I don't mind. This is my passion, so you're welcome to email me if there's any comments you want to make or if there's any questions that you want to ask.
Thank you. And two things, I'll attach that link to the podcast as well, and then that is also where listeners can buy your book. And they must please note that there's an English version and an Afrikaans version.
Yeah. Interesting enough, the book is available on Amazon.com.
Okay.
In Afrikaans and English. But there's the but. You can actually get it in Afrikaans paperback from Amazon.com. But if you're a South African, you then have to pay the import on those books.
Yeah.
And I think that's something like crazy, 600 rand. So what we have done is the ebooks are available on Amazon.com, and the English paperback across the world is also available on Amazon.com. But in South Africa, paperbacks, Afrikaans and English, are available on my website, which means that at least getting a book to you, it's much less costly than it would be to get it from Amazon.com.
Yeah. Before I let you go, may I ask you a fun question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, indeed.
A little bird told me that you love the outdoors.
Indeed. That's why I came to live and look at the Magaliesberg Mountain while I'm talking to you.
Yes. Jannie, if you were a very small and stealthy creature, which one would you be?
Wow. That is a difficult question, because there are so many little animals that go through my mind. I'm finding it difficult to say tumultuously, wow, this is what I would want to be. Maybe a little bird. Because again, sitting to you and watching all these different birds, maybe I would like to be a little bird. Which one? Oh, again, there's so many of them. Yeah, maybe a little fish catcher, which we saw lots and lots around the dam here.
Oh, they are beautiful.
And it's just amazing how they can actually maneuver themselves and how they structure things. You again can just go on your knees to think how clever these little birds are actually. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Jannie, for sharing your fresh view of learning and reading problems and highlighting a factor that we don't always take into consideration. And I really hope that this conversation and your book and your work will open new avenues for many listeners.
Mariette, thank you to you as well for creating the opportunity for me to do so. Thank you so much.
My great pleasure. And to our listeners, it was good of you to spend time with us. If this episode struck a chord with you and you know of someone who could benefit from it, please share it with them. Go to my website, www.marietsneeman.co.za, for free podcasts and articles on physical and mental health, romantic relationships, parenting, and navigating life's transitions. To follow me on Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, just search for Mariette Sneeman Journalist. The weekly podcast series Calm, Clear, and Helpful is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and other platforms. It's hosted and produced by me, with original music by Mart-Marie Sneeman. Catch you next Tuesday at 9:00.